You're listening to Radio Times Rewind. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Before American Bandstand with Dick Clark, there was Paul Whiteman's Teen TV Club.
As Griffin again brings you Paul Whiteman and the TV Teen Club in another half hour of sparkling music and fun.
It filmed at WFIL Studio at 46th and Market Streets in Philadelphia, and in the early 50s, a young kid from South Philly won a contest to be a regular on the show as a singer and drummer. That's when Robert Louis Ritterelli became Bobby Rydell.
Oh, wild one, I'm gonna tame you down now.
By the time Rydell was 21, he had six top 10 hits, including Wild One in 1960 and Volare from the same year.
Volare.
Cantare. In 1963, he had this smash, which remains a Jersey Shore anthem to this day. Rydell shunned the allure of Hollywood and stayed a local all his life. I spoke with him in 1992 when he was doing a run of shows with Peter Nero and the Philadelphia Pops. We start here with me asking Rydell when he started performing.
I would say somewhere around the age of 6 years old, 6 or 7 years old. If I had any talent whatsoever, the first one to see it was my father. And he took me down and I went to audition. There was a show here in town on the old WFIL, which
Now
PVI.
Yeah.
It's called the Paul Whiteman TV Teen Club. And I auditioned and I was a contestant on the show, and I won, and then I became a regular on the show for about 2.5 years, doing production numbers, getting involved, you know, things like that. And then the show went off the air. So at about the age of 9, I was out of work.
Now, you had a big kind of impersonation act, is that right?
That's basically what I did. Years ago, there was a record recorded by Sammy Davis Jr., who on one side he did actors doing singers and singers doing actors. I did the actors, you know. And it was the imitations that everybody and his brother did, you know, James Cagney and Edward G. Robinson, you know, things like that. And I still, to this day, in my act, you know, incorporate a lot of comedy.
Now, how does a six-year-old learn about Jimmy Cagney? And
just
all
by
watching TV?
Watching TV, yeah. I used to you know, sit in front of the TV and mimic everybody that I saw. And that's what my dad saw. And then the singing came along with it as well. I don't know, because my mom and dad always used to tell me when we would take drives down to Wildwood, New Jersey, my grandmother had a boarding house down there. And we used to go, of course, we didn't have the nice, you know, systems that we have now. We used to go down by a road called Tuckahoe Road. Mm-hmm. It was the back roads down to the seashore, and it was very, very bumpy. And I used to sing. That's what they tell me. And I was, shut up back there, you know.
but your parents were very supportive, at least your
father
was very supportive.
Yeah. My mom in the beginning, she said, my father said, Jenny, you know, look at the kid. He's got talent. My mother was like, oh, come on, you know, you're nuts. My father said, no, no. And my dad, as you said, you know, used to take me around to the CR Club, Scioli's, Palumbo's, the BR Club, just to get up, the Sons of Italy, get up and perform. He would ask the club owners, you would mind if my son gets up and sing a couple of numbers?
Yeah. And was that okay?
And, you know, at a very, very early age, you know, I got up on stage. Of course, there was a lot of nerves. I always used to tell my dad, you know, I don't feel too good, Dad. Can we go home? I got a stomach ache. You know, it was the nerves prior to going on. And then after, you know, doing what I did and people, you know, do that, I said, gee, that's a wonderful feeling. I mean, all I have to do is do this and they do that. You know, that's wonderful. And you know, it was ingrained in me at a very, very early age.
Now, did you get over the nerves in the stomach? Or is that still part of
how
you feel?
Yeah. Matter of fact, I just did a benefit for a very, very dear friend of mine, a priest up in the Wilkes-Barre Scranton area, to raise money for a school up there, Bishop O'Hara High School. And we stayed at the rectory. And there was a very, very bad bed in there. And Father Sika, who I did the show for, he said, "That's your penance. You have to you have to lay in this bed." But the pastor of the parish, he said, "Do you still get nervous, Bobby, before you go on?" Mm. I said, "I sure do, Father." He says, "I get nervous before I say Mass, too." You know, so I guess it's got to be there, you know.
But from what I read about you, you love to perform live. I mean, that's kind of where you live on the stage, I guess.
Yeah, it's kind of unfortunate that there are no more places like, I mean, even Palumbo's here in the city anymore. Very, very far and few in between are there shows there. Places like the Copacabana in New York are no longer existent. You know, the Chez Paris in Chicago, the Coconut Grove in Los Angeles. Because that was a marvelous time in my life, doing the cabaret circuit, mm-hmm. you know, working with the tinkling glasses and the smoke-filled rooms. You know, it's marvelous. But what I'm doing now in the city has been a dream for a long time. And from what I understand, they had wanted me to do something with the Pops Orchestra, you know, quite a few years ago, but schedule-wise did not permit it. So as luck would have it, me and three other buddies, we were going to go on a golf trip. We were going to go to Myrtle Beach for about, you know, 8-10 days, just tee it up and play, you know. And we had everything all set, the hotel, the airfares, you know, had all the golf courses picked out. And my manager calls, he says, "I have a date." I said, "Dick, now why are you doing this?" I said, "Not only are you messing me up," I said, "but I'm messing up three other guys." He says, "Bobby, it's at the Academy of Music with Peter Nero and the Philly Pops
Orchestra. How can you turn that down?"
I said, "Well, the golf ain't all that important at this particular moment in time." So this will be our third night, and it's absolutely marvelous. It's Peter is fantastic. He's just fantastic to work with. And the orchestra is superb. And I've worked in front of a lot of people in my lifetime. I've never had that many people behind me before in my life. I mean, it's
you find
it's,
yourself looking over your shoulder.
Oh, it's so lush. It's so lush. I mean, of course, I do, you know, a few of the songs that I've been associated with over the years. But I recorded a new album, which hopefully we'll be putting it out in hopefully the next couple of months or so. And we do songs on there like Bewitched, Bothered, and Bewildered, and Here's That Rainy Day. And just to hear that live, you know, with the full string section and the oboes and the French horns and the English horns is a thrill.
Now, when did you actually begin to perform, I mean, begin to sing as a performer?
As a professional?
Yeah.
Oh, I would imagine you'd have to say, being a professional, I think, is the first time you get paid, I guess, for a job. So actually, when I did the Sons of Italy, I think I got like $5.
And you were how old at the time?
Oh, I don't know, 7, 8. You know, but I guess it would have to be 1959, and that's when I had my first hit record, which you mentioned was Kissin' Time. So I guess that's when it actually all started, you know, professionally.
Now, you grew up in South Philly, and you actually even played in a band that you had, and Frankie Avalon was part of that band.
Yeah, yeah. Well, actually, I was just a fill-in. There was a drummer in the band, I believe his name was Chippy Peters, who got the flu or something, and he couldn't make the job for, you know, a week or something like that. And the band was working at a place called Bay Shores in Summers Point, New Jersey, which is no longer there. And Frank and I knew one another. We used to do, you know, USO shows and veterans hospitals and things like that in and around the area. And I just filled in for Chippy Peters, and Frankie was playing trumpet. And that's where I met my first manager, a man by the name of Frankie Day. He was working with a group called Dave Apple and the Applejacks that had a couple of big records of Bunny Hop and so on and so forth. And I sang. I played drums. I did some impersonations, and he came up to me and said, "I'd like to manage you." Oh, well, you know, I
and you here
I,
you are a teenager,
you know,
right?
I said, "I don't know. Talk to my father," you know, and that's basically how it all started.
Well, do you have any theories about why Philadelphia created people like you and Fabian, Frankie Avalon, Eddie Fisher, James Darren, Joey Bishop? I could go on and on.
It really does. It really goes on forever. I mean, I've been asked that question, you know, so many times. You know, no matter
something in the water down there.
Well, exactly. I would say there was a water trough on 9th and Dickinson. You see, and if you drank out of that water trough, you became a singer. If you put your feet in it, you became a dancer. I don't know. I don't know. I don't know. Maybe the Dick Clark Show has something to do with that. I'm talking about, you know, myself and Avalon and Chubby Checker and Fabian, you know, James. Well, not James Darren. He was kind of like really the first one to leave the city to become an actor, you know. But I don't know. Our city has been blessed, you know, with a lot of talented people.
Well, you had it took you a little while, I guess, to get that first hit, Kissing Time, and
Yeah.
I mean, you were still young when it happened.
Well, I met Frankie Day, and I think it was around 1956, and we went around to different, you know, recording companies. And auditioned, and everybody said, no, how many teenage idols can there be? You know, everybody's made it so far. And so then my manager and my dad decided to put up a little bit of money, and we went into a recording studio with a couple of people from the Baltimore, Washington area. And I recorded a song called Dream Age. It was terrible. It was absolutely,
did you know that at the time?
Oh, it was absolutely horrendous. I mean, that was the first time I was, you know, in front of a mic. In a recording studio with musicians, so that was kind of a different ballpark for me. And it was bad. It was really a bad record, and unfortunately, it's still available around today. You can find it. And these two guys from Baltimore and Washington, they split and left my dad and my manager with, you know, the studio time cost, the tape cost, the engineer cost, the musician cost. And as luck would have it, we came back home. And I auditioned for Bernie Lowe, who was the president of Cameo Records, and he liked me, signed a contract, had three or four records, nothing happened, finally turned around to myself and I said, I was happier playing drums.
Yeah.
I was really having a great time playing drums, you know, with bands.
And Frankie Avalon was doing real well at the time.
And Frank, let me see, I was 1959, I think Frank was about late 57, you know, 58, something like that. And then Bernie Lowe and Cal Mann and Dave Apple, who were like, you know, the brainstorms of Cameo, they wrote most of my material that I recorded, other than like, say, Volare, Sueo, Black Magic. But they wrote a song called Kissin' Time. I recorded it with a group who used to work Wildwood, New Jersey, a group called Georgie Young and the Rockin' Box. And we did it in a room that was, you know, so tiny, two track, you know, none of the high tech stuff like today. Recorded it, sound good, put it out.
No big deal, right? I mean, just another song.
You know, who knew? This could have been like the fifth one that, you know, wasn't going to do anything. And as luck would have it, that turned out to be the first hit record.
This is Kissing Time, sung by my guest, Bobby Rydell.
They're kissing in Cleveland, Kansas City team. They're wailing in Wildwood, back in Waterloo. They're scooching all over, even in St. Louis. So baby, get ready, I'm kissing you. Oh baby, cause summertime is a kissing time, USA. So treat me right, don't make me fight the battle of New Orleans tonight. They're kissing on beach.
That's Bobby Rydell singing Kissing Time. Now, what do you think made that song a hit?
I think it's because we named every city in the United States, possibly. You know, they're kissing in Cleveland, Kansas City, too. They're here, they're there, they're all over the place, you know, Cleveland, Ohio. Matter of fact, I think that's where the record really first broke, was in Cleveland, Ohio, rather than here in Philadelphia. And I don't know if you were really paying attention, it had that hand clap and bass drum thing that went, and it was like the hook. Ba-boom, boom. Everybody was waiting for that ba-boom, boom, you know, on the record. So possibly because it mentioned a lot of cities and the ba-boom, boom made it a hit record.
Now, you were 17 at the time.
Yeah.
How did you handle having a hit record?
I've been very, very blessed and lucky in my life. I mean, being born and raised in South Philadelphia and of Italian heritage, you know, I live with my mom, my dad, and my mom's grandparents, who, of course, came over from the old country. And there was a lot of love and warmth and respect in the house. And my first management, a man by the name of, like I said, Frankie Day, as corny as it may sound, he says, remember, Bobby, whatever happens to you in this business, he says, you'll meet the same people going up the ladder as you do coming down.
Well, Let me just—I was reading the back of one of your albums, and Frankie Day called you one of the most well-adjusted teenagers he'd ever met.
Well, that's very, very nice. Well, I think that's because of you know, mom and dad and grandpop and grandmom and the nuns at the Epiphany Parish.
So you still had to do your homework,
right? Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Definitely so. But Frankie said, you meet the same people going up the ladder as you do coming down. So if you happen to be a rotten guy while you're up there, and if you happen to be sliding, they give you a kick to get down there, you know, a little bit quicker. So if they say nice guys finish last, well, then I'm in that ballpark, and that doesn't bother me.
But I would think secretly you would say to yourself, oh, my God, I mean, I got a hit record.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, Kissin' Time was one thing. Then the second thing was We Got Love. And then my first million seller was Wild One. And I used to go into the office after school every day, and I would go into the accountant's department, and I would see orders from like 100,000 records, Chicago, 200,000, Detroit, 300,000, Philadelphia. Whoa, this is it. This is really it. This is the biggie. Yeah. But thank God, I mean, it really didn't affect me. You know, it didn't turn my mind around, and I think I'm a pretty level-headed guy.
So did your lifestyle change at all? I mean, did you move to a bigger house?
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, South Philadelphia, you know, will always be my home. It just happened that I grew out of my home. I was, you know, amassing so much clothes and shoes and this and that and the other memorabilia, records and things from fans, and I had nowhere to put it. I mean, our basement or cellar, you know, we didn't have basement. We had a cellar. You know, my grandfather had two wine barrels in the back. My grandmother had a big table that she would make the homemade macaronis. So we had to move, you know, and we moved up to the main line in Penn Valley. And it's at that time, it's going on to 29 years now, it was my grandmother, my grandfather, my mom, my dad.
All living together.
Yeah, and now my grandparents have passed away, but my mom and my dad, my wife and myself and my two children, we live up there.
That's great.
Yeah, it is.
Now, you were born with the name Robert Louis Ritterelli.
Right.
Whose idea was it to change it to Bobby Rydell?
Well, actually, it was my dad. As far as the media is concerned, it was always Paul Whiteman, who I mentioned earlier, because it made better press at that time that Paul Whiteman came up with the name Bobby Rydell because he could not pronounce Robert Louis Ritterelli. Okay?
Was it too ethnic, though, considered to be too ethnic back then?
No, I don't think so, because even the nuns, excuse me, in school, it was sometimes Master Ritterelli, you know, I'm going to make you sweat putty balls this summer, Master Ritterelli. Putty ball, sister?
Ritterelli?
Ritterelli. So, you know, a lot of people pronounce the name Ritterelli, you know, so Rydell. And my, you know, when I finally was entering into show business, my dad said, well, we need a show business name, you know, Rydell. That's how it came out.
Okay, well, Bobby Rydell is my guest today on Radio Times. Hi, you're on Radio Times.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I would like to ask Bobby Rydell.
Not Blavitt, no.
Went to Southeast Catholic High School.
That's correct, yes.
You did?
Well, actually, it was originally called South Catholic, Southeast Catholic. That was located on 7th and Christian. And then that closed down, and the school became Bishop Newman High School, which was on 26th and Moore, I believe, 26th and Tasker Moore.
Yeah.
And so, yes, you're right. When you mentioned earlier, Jerry Blavitt and I, we went to Bishop Newman together.
What years were you there, Bobby?
I would have graduated the class of 1960, but I left high school somewhere in between my junior year because I was that's when things started happening for me and I was on the road.
Do you have regrets about leaving high school now?
Quite a few years ago, a friend of mine, Father Frigo, from Bishop Newman, he said, Bobby, would you come and do, you know, something for the school, a show? I said, sure, Father, no problem. He said, how much do you want? I said, Father, I don't want no money. I said, are you kidding? I said, I'll tell you what I would like to have, Father. I'd like to have my diploma and my high school graduation ring. And they made it up for me. They made it up.
So you are a high school graduate.
Class of 1960 and my diploma.
That's great.
Yeah, it was marvelous. It really was.
Did you have another question, sir?
Yes, sir. Does Bobby remember a priest at Southeast Catholic called Father McDevitt?
I remember Father McDevitt, yeah. I remember a lot of priests.
Bobby, this is Father McDevitt calling.
You're kidding.
No, it is not.
Oh,
that's wonderful.
How are you, Father?
I'm fine, thank you. I have many happy memories of teaching down South Catholic. I was there from 46 to 56, and then they changed me up to Cardinal Doherty. I was there until 1970, and now I'm the retired pastor of St. Patrick's Church in Malvern.
Oh, that well, you're not all that very, very far from us, are you, Father?
Oh, I'm not. It was nice to talk to you. God bless you.
Thank you. Same here, Father.
Thanks for your call.
How about that?
That's great. Let's take another call. Hi, you're on Radio Times.
Hi, my name is Phil Coschetti, and I went to school with Bobby at the Epiphany of Our Lord.
That name rings a bell.
Jackson Streets.
Yeah.
And Bobby and I were in 7th, 8th grade together, and I remember attending a party with him where he played the drums and imitated Red Skelton.
Now, did you think back then that Bobby Rydell would become who he did?
Well, he was always talented. It was obvious to all his classmates that he was very, very talented. At the time, I was not aware of his career. I'd been listening to the show and didn't realize that Bobby was doing all those engagements all around me. I just was oblivious to that at the time. But in our school contacts and our social contacts, attending the parties, you could see that the talent was there.
Oh, that's great.
Gee, Phil, that's wonderful. Thank you. I guess we were in the same class with Sister Saint Cecilia.
Yes, that's right.
And then Sister Saint Basil.
Yeah, that's right. You remember the names, I didn't.
I used to get hit a lot.
With the old ruler on the knuckles.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Lucy
Osi. Oh, that's one of my best. Lucy Osi, Joe Priori.
That's right, Joe Priori, Anthony D'Ambre.
Anthony Animal.
Geez, I'm going to leave and just let you two talk. How's that?
Oh, yeah, it was great.
I just wanted to say hello, and the last time I saw you, you were in the New Year's Day parade, and I reached up and shook your hand. You were walking on a float. I think at that time I was a policeman with the city of Philadelphia, and that's been years ago,
uh-huh.
So I'm sure you remember that parade.
Yes, I sure do, Phil.
But you take care of yourself.
Thank you, buddy.
I wish you well.
Thank you. Same here.
All right, bye.
Thanks, Phil,
Thank you, Phil, for calling in.
Bye-bye. Now,
it's amazing. It's great.
You had what was called the highest pompadour in the world.
Well, yeah, that's left. That's gone. It's all gray and it's not that high
anymore.
You
got a hat on, so I can't check it out.
It's gone.
Now, what did you do how much did you pour in there to make this pompadour?
What the heck was the stuff we used to use back then? What was it called? We used to use Vitalis, Brill Cream, a little dabble, do you? Now I need a lot of dabs.
But you would just work it up into this huge...
It kind of like just went that way. You know, I combed it. There's a singer in town who I believe he still has the club, Dick Lees, right? And I was on a show with him with Ted Mack years ago, okay? Remember, it was the old Major Bose, amateur show. And I used to pattern my hair after his because he had blonde hair, and in the front he had like a tunnel that looked like it went back forever. And I tried to do that, and I got a little bit of a tunnel, But I don't know, the hair just kind of went that way, And God forbid if it moved,
Well, it wouldn't move, would it, with all that stuff?
Hairnet? Was that it? Hairnet that the ladies used to use?
Yeah.
You become like a rock.
That was Bobby Rydell speaking with me in 1992. In just a moment, we'll be back with more Radio Times Rewind, including Rydell's take on how tastes change because of the Beatles and the Rolling Stones.
Of course, a lot of the jockeys, are playing British, mm-hmm. and the 45 record industry, as far as Americans were concerned, was going right out the window.
She wore blue velvet. Bluer than velvet was the night. Softer than satin was the light from the stars. She wore blue velvet. Bluer than velvet were her eyes. Warmer.
This is Radio Times Rewind. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Let's get back to my 1992 interview with South Philly legend Bobby Rydell, who was part of a wave of clean-cut teen idols in the late 1950s and early 60s. We start here talking about his experience navigating throngs of screaming fans.
Now, what was it like for you to be singing to literally a sea of screaming female faces?
The very first time that I did the Dick Clark Saturday Night Show, which came out of the Little Theater in New York City, and I can remember, you know, like watching Frankie and Fabe and, you know, the girls screaming and so on and so forth. So the first time that I did the show was when I had Kissin' Time. And, of course, when you do TV, you know, you're marked, you know, because you're lit and the cameras, you know, so on and so forth. So, and of course, like, to get the reaction from the girls, you know, me like an idiot, I'm moving closer to the stands and the girls are trying to grab me, you know, and the director's coming out. He's going, "Get back! You're out of your light. We can't see you." But it's scary.
Scary.
Sure, it's
because
scary.
They can stampede the stage.
There's always been security, but I can remember quite a few times, you know, like leaving the stage where police would just have to form like a flying wedge, and I would be put in the middle, and there was no stopping. I mean, you just had to, once you started, you had to go, whether you were getting onto, you know, into a bus, or is there a limo waiting for you, whatever it may be. There was no stopping whatsoever because. I really didn't feel, you know, that concerned about myself, but I mean, you know, kids could, you know, bada bing, bada boom, bada bang, fall down, break an arm, break a leg. I mean, there were many times, you know, ties have been, you know, my ties, you know, I'm choking, you know.
Well, they want a piece of you, right?
They want something, a cuff link, a tie, you know, an eye, a nose, an ear, a tooth.
Now, how did you keep your feet on the ground, though, with all that attention? And was it really just your family just reminded?
Yeah,
I mean, you still had to take out the trash.
Yeah, really. Yeah. I mean, I'm really down, you know, that's one of the reasons why I've never moved to the West Coast. I hate the West Coast.
You know? Tried it, too, right?
Oh, well, the only reason I was out the West Coast for any length of time was when I made Bye Bye Birdie. That was 6 months making the motion picture. And it was like, go out with this and go and do this. And because everybody, and the picture's got to be taken. And who's feuding and who's fighting and who's, come on, leave me alone. You know, Anne Margaret and I got along. She is just a tremendous lady, absolutely unaffected by all of her success. And, I mean, we talk to this day. She'll call and my mother, she goes crazy. And my aunt says, "Hello, Mrs. Ritterelli, is Hugo at home?" She says, "Oh, and you know," she goes all goofy. And Frankie Avalon says, "Bobby," he says, "come on, move out to the coast. We'll play golf every day." I said, "Frank, by the time I move out to the coast, Nevada's going to be oceanfront property." Even it's scary out there.
You just didn't feel like
the
like
fire,
you fit
the
in.
Mud, the earthquakes, yeah. and it just seemed like. Very, very, very plastic, you know. I know that's old. It's an old, you know, cliche, but it's the truth, you know.
Let's take another call. Hi, you're on Radio Times.
Hi, Bobby.
Yes.
I wanted to talk to you about how you recorded back then compared with recording techniques today.
Oh, it's like night and day.
Listening to Kissin' Time, I mean, obviously, they did have reverb and all that. But,
oh, yeah, yeah.
But you had a live band in the studio with you, right?
That was a live band, correct. Yes. If you were listening earlier, it was a group who used to work the Rainbow Club in Wildwood, New Jersey, Georgie Young and the Rockin' Box. And we went into a studio. Oh, I mean, it was really, really tiny. What would you say the size of the studio is here?
This is probably, what, 20 by 15?
Okay,
like
I would
that.
Say the studio wasn't, you know, much bigger.
Than that one you're in right now.
Exactly. Yeah. And there was one little room that had one tape recorder, was an Ampex tape recorder.
Ampex 350, no doubt.
Right, the old machine. And there was a door that you closed.
Yep.
The band was in the room. Mic'd. I was live with the band, mic'd, and you roll tape.
How many takes?
How many
takes?
Takes.
Do you remember for Kissin'
Time?
How many times do you have to go through it?
Oh, geez. Tell you the truth. I think
probably
South Philly.
Tell you the truth. I think we must have got it on. I'd say maybe the fifth time down.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And compare that with today.
Oh, well.
And you said you just have finished cutting an album.
Yeah, I just finished cutting an album, and we did this with, and when I say we, a fellow musician here in Philly, Mike Pettison Jr., who's a marvelous player, and a trumpet player by the name of Evan Solot, who both produced and orchestrated the album. Well, we went into the studio live at a place called K-Gem in Gladwin, and a gentleman by the name of Mitch Goldfarb was the engineer, and we went in with the four trumpets, four trombones, five saxophones, piano, bass, drums, guitar, percussion, live. And Mike said, "Bobby, we can't do this live. We have to layer it." I said, "No, Mike. I want to go in and do it live. I want the big band sound. You know, I don't want it, you know." And not, what I'm trying to say anyway is that nothing is synth. You know, everybody on the recording is human. You know, it's a human trumpets, human trombones, human saxophones.
It's not a lot of synthesizers.
No, it's not a drum machine. You know, my own drummer, David Kovnat, you know, came in, and we were there in Philadelphia for 5 days recording about 10 tracks. Now, the studio itself, although it was kind of large, we did not have room to put 20 strings in the studio when we did the date. You know, so we had to use their alternate studio here in Center City, K-Gem in Center City, to overdub the 20 strings.
But this is what you're talking about, live performing.
Oh, yeah. That's you can't beat it.
Well, and I think that was my point. God bless you for doing it live with the band there, because there has been a complaint about some of the recordings done today that they lack what happened in the 60s and the 50s when they were literally done.
Yeah, sure. I mean, there's
they're not exciting.
No, they're not exciting. And I mean, even in a live performance, I mean, if I go to hear, you know, somebody like a Pavarotti or Sinatra or Steve Lawrence and Edie Gourmet, Johnny Mathis, you know, if there's like a little, it's human. You know, those things happen. Everything is not perfect.
Sure.
You know, those things. And you say, yeah, okay, this is the way it's supposed to be.
But with the other system, or the system that many people are using, it might be technically perfect, but it misses some of that human
technically
element.
Perfect, yes. The human element is gone.
Yeah, and I think that was the point. Especially your recordings, a lot of yours in the 60s were extremely exciting in terms of, Marty, you asked him what made that record a hit.
Yeah.
I think it was not only the boom boom, but also the fact that it was a live recording. I mean, it had real live sound. And that's true. And I think that's been lost in a lot of things today that are technically perfect and technically dead.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It really is unfortunate. You're correct.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Very, 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 very true.
Well, thanks for calling in. I want to play another Bobby Rydell song. Thanks for calling in. Bye-bye now.
Thank you.
Okay. Let's play, and this is from Bye Bye Birdie, and this is actually an album that we found, with some effort we found, where you sing all the music of Bye Bye Birdie, and this is a song called One Girl.
One girl, one special girl, one girl to go with, to talk with and walk with. One girl, that's the way it should be. One girl, one certain girl, one girl to laugh with, to joke with, have coke with. One girl, not two or three. One day you find out.
That's One Girl, sung by my guest, Bobby Rydell. Now, I will tell you, I watched Bye Bye Birdie last night, and it was such a sentimental reminiscence for me, I must say.
Yeah.
And I was surprised how, maybe because I was 12 or 13 when I saw it, I remembered every single gesture. It's a great movie. I mean, it's a great dated movie.
Yeah, it really is. And the people in the picture, God rest his soul, you know, Paul Lynde, was marvelous, you know, on the set. Dick Van Dyke and Janet Leigh, Maureen Stapleton, Anne Margaret. Our director, George Sidney, was a marvelous man to work for. Producer Fred Colmar, Columbia Pictures. When we were doing the picture, if you remember the scene when Conrad first comes to town, and it's supposed to be, that was, the, we filmed that at Universal.
And he comes in on his motorcycle.
Comes in on his motorcycle with the mayor and his wife, and he starts singing, you know, "You Got to Be Sincere," and the mayor's wife faints and everybody faints. Well, the next lot over, when we were doing Birdie, Alfred Hitchcock was filming The Birds. And like when we had breaks, we used to run over. And the one thing we saw them do, if you remember, where the car pulls up to the gas station and the car is getting full with gas and the cigarette and the car blows.
Oh, yeah.
The car blows up. Yeah. We saw them do that.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And, you know, the decoy, the birds, you know. It was kind of hip, you know.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah,
that's
was.
Great. Let's take some more calls. Hi, you're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi.
My name is Karen, and I'm from Gary, Indiana.
Hi, Karen from Gary, Indiana.
I really want to tell Bobby how much his music inspired dancing. You know, Gary, when I went back there when I was a teenager, Gary was a very big dancing town. And I have a record of his, which when I presented to my girlfriends, we screamed at the record. I mean, he wasn't there. It was ridiculous. We must have screamed for 25 minutes at the record, but we have played.
This is just looking at Bobby Rydell's face?
Yes, and the music. I mean, it was so great. It was so inspiring. And to this day, I do. I have this record in front of me right now. I happen to live in Philadelphia, and it has songs on it like Cha-Cha-Cha, uh-huh. The Best Man Cried, I'll Never Dance Again.
Oh, yeah. Are you speaking about an album?
Yes, an album of yours, an album. Which is very inspiring and fantastic to dance to.
Yeah, I think is that Biggest Hits Volume 2?
Biggest Hits Volume 2, and it had a little record inside, and I believe that was Swingin' School.
You probably know a lot better than I do. Yeah, I don't remember all of it, to tell you the truth.
We had many hours of fun dancing to your music. I just want to let you know that.
That's
and
very,
do you
very
still
nice.
Dance to Bobby Rydell's music?
Well, you know, I teach tap dancing now, and I'm thinking about maybe I could choreograph to one of these pieces. It would be a lot of fun.
Yeah. What would you tap dance to, though? That's you know, you can't tap dance to the cha-cha-cha, or I'll never dance again.
You know, not that one.
You can't do. Well, you know, you can't tap dance to I'll never dance again.
True. Maybe something like Good Time Baby.
Yeah, I think that would work. Yeah, you could probably hoof. You could probably hoof to Good Time Baby.
Well, thanks a lot.
My pleasure. Thank you for calling.
Thanks for calling in, Karen.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye, Karen. Let's take another call. Hi, you're on Radio Times.
Hi, this is Guy Raymond.
Hi, Guy.
From Cape May.
Hi, Guy.
Hey, you know the...
On the way to Cape May.
Well, yeah. That guy lives right down there in Cape May Beach that made that popular. What's his name?
Al Alberts.
Al Alberts.
Al Alberts.
Okay.
But what I wanted to say was from Bye Bye Birdie, one of the scenes that I'll never forget and that really cracked me up was when... Dick Van Dyke's mother in the movie tried to gas herself by sticking her head in an electric oven. Remember
kids.
That?
And then they sing the song "Kids, What's the Matter with Kids?"
Oh, that was a great song.
Oh, yeah, there was
that turtle scene, that turtle running
around. Oh, yeah, there was so many great moments in that picture.
Hey, thanks for calling in.
Hey, okay, nice talking to you.
Same
nice
here,
to have
you.
A call. Bye bye. Did you read for The Graduate for the Dustin Hoffman part?
Yeah. There, a gentleman out on the West Coast by the name of Lynn Stallmaster, who was a casting director and still today is a very, very well-respected casting director in California, Hollywood. And I read the part, you know, the Dustin Hoffman part. And Lynn Stallmaster went to Jack Nichols.
Jack Nichols.
And he said,
Mike Nichols.
Mike Nichols, and it was Mike Nichols and Elaine May, right?
Okay.
Mike Nichols, and he said, gee, I just heard a marvelous reading by Bobby Rydell. And from what I understand, Mike said, nah, it's not the look. You know, it's not what I'm looking for, you know. And it was kind of like a blow, you know. But then, you know, when you saw the motion picture, it's two completely different, you know, looks, you know. So he was evidently looking for a specific look in Dustin Hoffman. What are you going to do?
Let's take another call. Hi, you're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi.
Karen, another Karen.
Another
Hi, Karen.
Hi. I was wondering if you had a mentor who you admired. You seemed to, when you were a teenage singer, you seemed to have such a well-developed voice, and you still seem to have so much more staying power. Did you have voice training?
Oh, yeah. Matter of fact, when I was on the Paul Whiteman Show, Bernie Lowe, who later became my boss, was the piano player on the Paul Whiteman Show, okay? I took voice lessons from Bernie. Then there was this, a studio here in town, a gentleman by the name of Artie Singer. I went to him for about 3 years. And then I was coming into maturity, you know, and Artie said to my mother, he should stop, you know, taking singing lessons now because he's going to go through a vocal change, which can, you know, hurt. So I did and continued to sing, but didn't continue on the with the lessons. And then later on, after the hit records and so on and so forth, there was there's a gentleman in New York by the name of Marty Lawrence who I consider him one of the finest mm-hmm. vocal coaches that I've ever had the extreme good fortune of working with.
How would you describe your voice now? What are you able to do now that you weren't able to do when you were 20?
Well, first of all, I think it's, I've matured, of course, quite a bit, and I've lived a heck of a lot longer, you know, since 17 years old, seen a lot of things, you know, happen in my lifetime. And I think basically when I sing songs like A Rainy Day or Bewitched, Bothered, and Bewildered, I can relate to a lot of things that the lyrics are saying right now, whereas at 17 years old, it's just not believable. You know, people are saying, you know, how could Rydell be singing Rainy Day at 17 yeah. years old? What the heck does he know about anything of falling in and out of love and things like that, you know? So that's one way. Another way, I think my voice has matured considerably and has grown with texture. To me it feels like a wine, you know, that, you know, has aged over the year, and thank God, you know, God has been very, very good to me and vocally. And I smoke like crazy.
You do?
Oh,
I, you still smoke?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I wish I could stop. I really do.
Wow, how much do you smoke?
About a pack and a half.
Do you really?
Yeah, yeah.
And you managed to keep your voice and smoke.
Yeah, yeah. Jerry Lewis almost killed me when I worked with him last summer. Not that he said, what are you doing? He says, don't you see? He said, you sing so beautiful. Throw those, he said, I said, yeah, I'm going. He says, no, you can't say yeah, you got to do it right now. Throw those, I said, okay, I'll do it. No, you can, don't tell me, okay, he's going crazy. He said, you know, plus he had the heart attack, you know, and he sure. just, you know, exited the cigarettes, over.
Well, has the smoking taken some of the top range off your voice?
No, okay. Not at all. It's weird. No, I mean, I can get up to like A's, A flats, you know, with no problem above the scale, mm-hmm. you know, above C, which is, you know, it's pretty good. And my lows come out fine, you know.
Well, Marty and I are still worried about you.
Well, thank you. Yeah, thank you very much. That's
I'm not going to berate you on the air, though.
No, I grew up in Illinois, and I didn't know all those songs were about places on the shore and Jersey and Philly and everything until I moved out here, you know.
Uh-huh.
But it was great music, and it's so neat that you're keeping our music alive and still doing your own thing and developing.
Thank
very
you, Karen.
Very exciting.
Thank you very, very much.
Thanks for your call,
yeah.
Karen, number two.
Karen,
yeah,
number two.
Thanks a lot. Now, did you ever perform with another Philadelphia legend, Chubby Checker?
Oh, yeah, Chubby and I were on the same label on Cameo. As a matter of fact, we recorded an album together, just basically Bobby Rydell and Chubby Checker, and it was released during the Christmas period, although it specifically wasn't a Christmas album. Yeah. Had some songs in there. And the album went gangbusters. It, you know, I don't think we had platinum back then. It went gold, you know. But, yeah, we of course, you know, Dick Clark shows and, yeah.
When the Beatles and the Rolling Stones and the real rock
right.
music of the late middle to late 60s came,
right.
is that what really kind of changed your
career? Oh, I think
career?
So, yeah. That was my last hit record for Cameo was late 63, early 64, and was my last million seller, a song called Forget Him.
Mm-hmm.
And then in 64, I went into the service. I took my basic training at Fort Dix, New Jersey, and I was in the service for five and a half, 6 years. I was National Guard. Sleep well tonight, your National Guard is awake. I was at a 32nd in Lancaster, 103rd Combat Engineer Battalion, and I went away. My MOS was typist. and I came back and there was a typist in our unit. So I built bridges for 5.5 years, right? But we had a marvelous unit. We had so much fun. And we used to go to summer camp places like Camp Drum, New York, you know, Indian Town Gap. And I got away from the original question. What was it?
Well, whether the 60s was a hard
time. Oh, yes. Okay.
And you have about 30 seconds
30
to
seconds.
Answer.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, the British invasion and, of course, a lot of the jockeys, you know, not only here in Philadelphia, but across the United States were playing British. Mm-hmm. And the 45 record industry, you know, as far as Americans were concerned, was going right out the window. And I think then after a couple of 3-4 years, they decided to say, hey, you know, let's start playing American product, you know, like let's start buying American cars, you know, and stop with this foolish stuff.
Chubby, yeah. Teach me to twist. Chubby, uh-huh. Teach me to twist. Well, if I don't know how, look at all I miss. I just watch me now when I move like this. Come on, Chubby.
That was Bobby Rydell singing with another South Philly legend, Chubby Checker, in 1960. I spoke with Rydell in 1992. He died at the age of 79 in 2022. Joining me now in the studio is WHYY executive producer Kevin McCory, who helped me sort through the archives to make this Radio Times Rewind series. Hi, Kevin.
Hey,
nice
Marty.
To have you back on the show.
So the elephant in the room, let's just get it right out of the way.
Do it.
You got a massive crush on Bobby Rydell.
Yeah, I didn't when I was in fourth grade. I was a Fabian fan. I was a member of the Fabian fan club. But I have to say, Bobby Rydell was, as I think you hear in the interview, just fun to talk to,
yeah.
Full of memories. His ability to recall names and dates from the past was pretty extraordinary.
But I got the sense listening to it that it was like he was a guy you had a poster in your room or you were flipping
no,
through
was
the magazine.
No, I was strictly Fabian.
There were sides to this back then?
There were definitely sides to this. No, but he was all part of those singers that us, you know, boomers back in fourth, fifth, and sixth grade were just, you know, crazy about.
Could you take us back to that era when you were like, you know, a young person and like what was the music scene like in your mind back then?
In my mind, well, it was standing on my toilet in front of the mirror in my bathroom, pretending to be a member of the Supremes or probably singing along with Bobby Rydell or Fabian, but just wanting to be part of this whole, we heard it with Patti LaBelle too,
yeah.
Part of this whole musical scene that was just happening in front of our eyes. And it was very catchy. As you know, these are very
yeah.
catchy songs. I mean, designed to move and dance. I remember The Twist, of course.
Did you like have a sense that, oh, these are people from the area that I live in? Or was it almost like it didn't matter at that point?
Well, you know, I wasn't from South Philly. I'm sure if I lived in South Philly, I mean, I would own these people. I was growing up in Delaware.
Right.
So
it was still the area.
It was still the area. But, you know, I was a country girl. I didn't know much about the big city.
Okay. And so when you have Bobby in studio there in 1992, I mean, what were you thinking going into that and how was he and all that?
No, I was excited. I mean, it was this link to my past. We'd obviously done a little homework on him and he was just really open to talk to. I thought he was very honest and he sort of knew how crazy it was to be a teenage star, you know, at the age of 17 and 18. And he sounded very grounded. He talked about his parents and grandparents. He was living on the main line when I interviewed him, and he had lived with his parents. I think he moved his grandparents in with him. So it just sort of tells you the kind of guy that he was.
Yeah, I thought that was really interesting that kind of jumped out to me because you talked about Bye Bye Birdie, and he has this kind of great rapport with Anne Margaret in the movie. And it seemed like, I mean, I don't know all the ins and outs and what opportunities he had or didn't, but it seemed like if he wanted to have a career in Hollywood, maybe he could have.
Maybe.
But he opted for, you know, East Coast life, Philadelphia life, family life.
Yeah, family life. I mean, I think this is where he felt comfortable. This is where his people were.
And then I guess his early career, too, is just interesting. You know, this whole thing with Paul Whiteman's teen TV club, right?
Yeah.
Like, I hadn't heard of that before.
Me neither, frankly.
But I guess harkens to a time when Philadelphia really was like a major television broadcasting
right.
center. And, you know, American Bandstand came out of that. And just an interesting kind of time portal back to that era where a kid tries out for a contest, wins, becomes a regular on the show.
Yeah.
He can parlay that into a career. He gets a couple hits and all of a sudden he's a big name. And, you know, we were talking with some of the producers before the show. It's like, do people really remember Bobby Rydell? And does he have the kind of critical cachet? Not as much.
I don't think
as
so.
Not maybe even like a Chubby Checker.
Right.
But like at the time, I mean, six top 10 hits. Right. I mean, that's a huge amount of hits.
Indeed. And I think that was when music and teenagers were really connecting on the radio. You know, here we are on the radio. But there was something about turning on the radio and hearing these songs and just feeling like, this is about me, you know. And then, of course, the Beatles came and changed everything, Rolling Stones as well, as he does acknowledge.
Well, that was really interesting, I thought, because if you look at the history of rock music and you kind of have, you know, the people who really broke through first in terms of like mainstream rock and roll, Elvis, Chuck Berry, right? And then you almost have, it seems like, a little bit of a record industry sanitation of that. And like that's where kind of the Bobby Rydells and the Frankie Avalons come in. And they have these hits, but then the game is just completely changed with the British invasion.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think in certain ways we probably wanted to disown people like Bobby Rydell because we wanted to, and I think the music from, especially the Beatles for me, was just speaking to the world that I lived in and the interest that I had and how I saw things changing. And of course, in the backdrop, you've got Vietnam War, you've got all these things that are going on in the background that were not the kind of things that Bobby Rydell was going to be singing about, frankly.
So yeah, this is the last episode, at least in this run of Radio Times Rewinds that we have planned. Curious, just kind of your overall take going down memory lane here.
Well, it certainly was memory lane. And I, you know, before everything went on the air, I listened to it just so that I could remember what it was that we talked about. These interviews happened 20, 30 5 years ago. It just reminds me about what it's like when someone will reveal things to you in a long form interview, where hopefully they feel comfortable and you've done your homework. I always feel like that's such an important part of doing an interview, is being able to say to that person or transmit to that person across from you, that, which is, I got this. You don't have to do this interview by yourself. We're going to do this thing together. But it was fun. It was nostalgic. It made me miss certain parts of a daily radio show.
Well, it's been a blast, Marty.
It's been a blast, Kevin. Loved working with you.
You too. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you. This completes our 8-episode Radio Times Rewind special series on WHYY. Kevin McCrory and I are the executive producers of the show. Our engineer is Al Banks. You can find our back catalog, including interviews with Patti LaBelle and George Carlin, at WHYY.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We'd also love to get your feedback on the show. You can email talkback@WHYY.org. And don't miss my other show, The Connection, Friday and Sunday at noon, right here on WHYY.